Nature is a great designer. Velcro was created after burrs kept sticking to a Swiss engineer's trousers. Humans also mimic animals. Evolution, after all, is a powerful focus group on what works, what doesn't. In Japan, there's a pin-nose bullet train that travels 200 miles an hour. The engineer on the project was also an avid bird watcher. He modeled the train's design after a bird, a kingfisher's beak. But what would it look like if animals could turn the tables, use human designs to their advantage, and could we help them? Artist Jonathan Keats' current exhibit is called The Reciprocal Biomimicry Initiative. It opened this month in the Samick Art Museum at Bucknell in Pennsylvania. There are crazy pictures at hereandnow.org as we welcome him. Hi.
Hello.
So first of all, what's the thinking behind this? I mean, I broad-brushed it, but tell us more.
So I've been fascinated by biomimicry for a very long time, by all the inventions ranging from Velcro, for instance, as an early example, to more recently surgical cements, and as you alluded to, the bullet train in Japan. And what I've observed as I've researched these inventions is that they're really great for us, but not necessarily so good for the species that came up with them in the first place, or more broadly, that our technologies have made the world much more difficult for life on the planet aside from us. And as a result, it seemed to me that really we needed to start thinking about how we could turn the equation, that somehow we could potentially benefit them, or in other words, that they could take up our inventions in the way that we take up theirs,
right,
and that they could make use of those inventions for their own benefit.
Now, you're an artist.
Indeed.
And so are you also a bit of a scientist?
I am by training a philosopher who escaped that field and came back around to it through the back door of art. I'm interested most of all in exploring provocations, I suppose, for lack of a better word, in the form of thought experiments, in the form of developing projects that allow us to enter into alternate realities, into parallel worlds.
Let's start with a model plane that's connected to a magnet that's to help flocks of birds whose migration habits might have been messed up because of climate change. Now, we've seen those remarkable stories of the people, the humans who go up in these little flying machines to try to get migrating birds back on course. Well, how does this work? They're not magnetized. You know, the magnet isn't so that they'll be drawn to a magnet, or sort of is it?
Well, in a sense it is, because birds fly based on the magnetic field produced by our planet. In other words, they have compasses inside their heads. So the idea was to create a network of sensors that would be able to guide drones, and those drones would be able to then in turn guide flocks of birds by canceling out Earth's geomagnetic field using a device known as a Helmholtz coil, and then superimposing another alternate field using an electromagnet. So in effect, from the bird's perspective, south might actually be southwest or even north. And as a result, the birds would end up flying in the direction that the drone did.
Okay, we can picture it. But it's kind of crazy. What else is going on here?
Where it gets more interesting for me is where all of this starts to fall apart, meaning does it really make much sense for us to have all of these flocks of drones as ways of getting birds around? Do we really want to bring other organisms into this kind of pileup of technology on top of technology that is very much the human way? To me, we kind of have gotten ourselves into this situation where technology causes problems, everything ranging from urbanization to climate change in terms of how our society functions or doesn't. And we tend to then choose other technologies or build other technologies in order to be able to get around those problems. And in the case of climate change, most famously, this would involve geoengineering, or in other words, spraying aerosols into the atmosphere, for instance, as a way of blocking the sunlight in perpetuity. And this way, to me, seems potentially to be unsustainable and certainly to be questionable in terms of the logic. So by bringing other organisms into this mindset, it brings us into a somewhat of an absurd space. And I hope it's funny in some way too, because I think if we start to laugh, we can stand back and we can look at what we do and think about it in terms of how we might otherwise move forward in our world.
I see that so clearly now. That how insane would that be to have these drones that are connected to a global climate sensing network that can find the optimal terrain and communicate with birds by manipulating their internal compasses? I mean, that's crazy. So I see this so clearly now, and that brings us to the sex toys for flowers. These are
indeed little, that probably is right, a perfect segue, isn't
right.
it?
But yeah, we'll have the picture again. It's little vibrators that you know are into the what are those stamen? Remind me of my flower structure to artificially
yes.
pollinate them.
Well, not to artificially pollinate them. We actually already are doing that quite a lot in terms of trying to contend with colony collapse disorder and the want of honeybees. So there are various techniques, one of which I believe uses something along the lines of a feather duster, and they work. But what got me thinking was the fact that they didn't seem like much fun for the plants. It seemed like while we could functionally keep them working on our behalf, keep the fruit trees going so that we would have fruit on the table, that perhaps we could stand back and think about what aspect of their life experience was lacking and whether we could provide that in, once again, the spirit of reciprocating on biomimicry. So what I did was I took vibrators that are used in cell phones and made them vibrate in the way that a honeybee would in mechanisms that can be attached directly onto the flower so that the flower does not get pollinated. There's no functionality to it. There's just the fact that the flower gets to experience vicariously a honeybee pollinating.
Right. I feel like I'm looking at the picture again and I feel like, oh, I should look away. That's private. You know, that fun they're having there. Well, so there's also the fiber optics for corals. You mentioned, you know, what if we could block the sun or in this case, provide an alternate energy source for like polluted oceans. We know the coral's dying.
Right.
And this would what? These cables are illuminated by LEDs?
Well, the easiest way probably, none of this is exactly easy,
right.
which is part of what interests me about it, would be to run fiber optics from the surface of the ocean using some sort of a solar concentrator, run the light down through potentially turbid waters so that the coral would be able to photosynthesize. But
and get
I've
sunlight,
been thinking about
yeah.
it more broadly in terms of, well, there are other ways of doing it. For instance, wave energy, or in other words, having generators that ride the waves. And so more broadly, what's interesting me here, and I've also been thinking about this in terms of trees on land, rainforests, and the possibility of having wind farms that would power them. It's this broader sort of attempt at looking at resilience and how we are increasingly concerned with the fact that climate change brings about less predictability. And as a result, we are building into our power networks, for instance, or into our power grids, ever more redundancy or more broadly looking to have multiple possible sources for energy in order to be able to make up for the fact that none of them is necessarily reliable. And mm-hmm. sunlight is not necessarily so reliable for a plant these days because cloud cover is not operational in the way that it has been in the past. And there's no stability ever.
Huh. Well, but again, I mean, you're third or fourth point is how insane, you know, to put fiber optics in the ocean to try to bring sun to the coral. Why don't we just, you know, get some of the pollution out of the ocean and see the sun more clearly? I mean, you know, maybe that's
right.
one of the messages there too. But I just have to mention one more. Urban camouflage for reptiles. There is a turtle with a camouflage, you know, for his shell, you know, much the way the military in urban combat is camouflaged. It would allow reptiles to elude detection when they're in urban areas.
And I found that people in the exhibition, people coming to visit the exhibition at the Samick Art Museum, may think that some of these are actually potentially quite practical. That's always the one that they stumble on and they start to laugh. And so I think that in a sense, it may be the most successful in terms of the thought experiment that I'm trying to bring out. Mm-hmm. I basically thought about how turtles have camouflage that doesn't really work very well for them in the urban environments they often live in these days. And so could we take camouflage and rethink it? We got the idea of camouflage from them or from other organisms more broadly.
Lizards and things have used it
with arguable success. So my thought is, could we go to our militaries and look at urban warfare as inspiration? So what I've done is I've given turtles urban camouflage using the same technique as is used for soldiers, wrapping camouflage over their helmets. Only in this case, the urban camouflage is wrapped over the turtle's shell.
Again, all the pictures at hereandnow.org. Artist and writer Jonathan Keats, his exhibit, The Reciprocal Biomimicry Initiative at the Samick Art Museum in Pennsylvania until June. But if you can't get there, you've got to see the pictures at hereandnow.org. Jonathan, best to you, which was very serious but also very sweet thinking. Thank you.
Thank you.